Hi, everybody. Welcome to week two of Clobberin' Time, the wrestling podcast. My name is Tom Bryan. I am a writer for StereoGum.com and assorted other freelance outfits. And my co-host is Damian Abraham.
Hey, Tom. How's it going, buddy?
It's good, man. I'm having a good week. I'm on vacation. I'm in North Carolina by the beach. It is beautiful. I am in a rental house that I would never, ever be able to afford, that my in-laws are brought my whole family out to. My brother-in-law is in from Hong Kong, or was until this morning. Yeah, man, so I'm doing beautiful. How about you?
Well, this week's been a little hectic. It's been a kind of a crazy week, but I'm doing great. You know, everything is good. I'm in Toronto, not on vacation, not in – well, actually, would that qualify as Flair country still?
I mean, I guess the entire state of North Carolina.
Yeah, the whole state. He claims the whole state. And so I guess, yeah, so that is Flair country. So, you know, I'm not in Flair country, but I am in Flavor country, as I am drinking in Earl Grey tea right now.
is Toronto like edge country? Does it have a stipulation on it?
I think we would be Drake country if we were anything, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, wrestling-wise, you're obviously in, what, the six? Did anybody ever call it the six before Drake?
Yeah, there's that guy that came up with it. There's another rapper that came up.
All right. Did you ever, like, refer to it as the six before Drake?
No. And I don't know how much I refer to it as the six now, but okay. I don't think I'm like, I'm not the, I might be a little out of the age range of the six saying people. I did refer to it as the T dot, though. So I'm like a Cardinal Official. I don't think that means anything to you, Tom. But
I know who Cardinal Official is, man.
Actually, that's right. You're a deep music.
I know about Northern Touch. I know about the song where he jumps on and pretty much spends an entire song being like, "You guys say this, and we say this." And then, like, tried to make it cool, and it wasn't cool. I watched a lot of Rap City in the early 2000s. I know these things.
Yeah. Was he on Rap City in America, or were you watching Canadian Rap City?
I was not watching Canadian Rap City.
Come on. Predates the American Rap City, I think.
I don't care.
Okay. I'm just saying. And actually,
I'm talking about BET, Big Tigger, okay, in the basement, that Rap City.
Yep. No, I know. We got BET up in Canada too after a certain point, but before that we had Rap City with Michael Williams, and he would host the Power 30, and then he would also host Rap City.
Okay.
And he's awesome now. I still see he does like some other thing on internet radio. This means nothing to you, Tom. I don't know. This could be. I'll save this for my glory days of Much Music when it was good podcast.
the disgruntled ex-employee podcast.
Yeah, but if we're talking about Toronto superstar music people that love pro wrestling, we got to talk about The Weeknd, because that guy, I have heard, is a huge pro wrestling fan.
Really?
That's what I've heard. So
that is not something that I would get at all.
No, but it makes sense, because you know, if you're of a certain age,
please explain why this makes sense.
Well, because I think if you're a kid, you probably were a wrestling fan, because up until this era, there was always sort of like wrestling, in the afternoons on a weekend, and now you don't really have that in the same way. You know, it didn't always seem like that. You could always watch wrestling.
I mean, I didn't get to watch TV as a kid. That's a whole other story. But when I had the opportunity to watch wrestling, I most certainly did.
And then actually, this might just be a Canadian thing, and that's why I'm like, oh well, he would have watched it on. But I have vivid memories of wrestling always being on the weekends, and and also just like wrestling. You know, you're a wrestling fan as a kid. Like, it's just something that kids naturally seem to gravitate towards. Like,
that is true.
And it's so. And I don't know why it makes sense, but it makes sense that The Weeknd would be a wrestling fan. It makes sense anytime someone's a wrestling fan. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Totally can see that.
Well, speaking of wrestling, we not a tremendously busy week in the world of professional wrestling, but there's some stuff happened. Anything you want to start off getting into?
I guess if I was going to start off talking about anything, I don't. When you say there, it's not a big week for wrestling. Every week is now a huge week for wrestling.
Well, yeah.
There's like, if you were trying to watch every single sort of like, you know, and this is a broad term, essential wrestling program, you would be on all the time listening to this stuff.
Yeah, I don't watch every wrestling show, but you wanted to talk about, you were one of the intrepid souls who continues to watch the weekly Ring of Honor television program.
Yeah. What, you think it's on the wane?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I just, I've watched it once or twice, like, ever.
Okay.
I went to a TV taping once in like 2012.
Okay.
And it was excruciating. They taped like a full month's worth of matches all at once, and there was long, long, long breaks while they were trying to get their cameras working or whatever.
Yeah.
And we got like, so we'd sit around for half an hour and then get like a 5-minute Kevin Steen squash and then sit around for another half an hour. Like it was bad. It wasn't fun. So
their TV's gotten a lot better. Their TV has gotten a lot better. Like this week had pretty much like the centerpiece of the whole episode was Colt Cabana versus Jay Lethal for the title. Though they had previously wrestled in Chicago at what was by all accounts an incredible event, and like tons of people were like losing it and just going crazy for everything that was going on.
Yeah, and that was one of those times I wish I was still in Chicago, because getting to see I love Colt, and getting to see him get that like big coming back to Ring of Honor hometown reaction, that had to be something special.
Oh yeah, it would have been incredible to get like to see what it was like. I don't know, just to see him get that, you know, like his due as a hometown hero and on that stage, because that's got to be like, you know, one of the bigger indie shows you could do at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And just for some background, Colt Cabana was in Ring of Honor for, you know, ever, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, he was part of, I think he was on like the second or third show that the company ever had. And he was with them up until he got signed to WWE, where he was in developmental hell for a couple of years and only got a couple moments on the main roster. And then he got fired again and went straight back to Ring of Honor. But he had disagreements with the management there a few years ago, and they basically just kicked him out. And he was pissed off about it. And, you know, we'd talk about it on his podcast and stuff like that. And so to see him come back to the company in a main eventer type of role is a cool thing.
Yeah. Like, no, sorry, go on.
Yeah. So that's, and then Jay Lethal is the champion there and has been the champion, got to be like a year now, right?
Oh, yeah. No, he's had it for over a year at this point.
Okay.
And he's now, they've got like sort of this hot sort of thing going on. With program, I guess, with the Bullet Club North America, and Bullet Club North America have shaved his head. And so this is his first match having had his head shaved, and he was taking Colt Cabana on for this rematch because their previous match was interrupted by, I believe it was that debut show by the North American Bullet Club, which of course is like the Young Bucks and Adam Cole.
Okay.
They haven't had any people to that yet. So I guess the Young Bucks are Bullet Club International, but I think up until this point is Adam Cole is just Bullet Club North America. I don't think he's been in Bullet Club Japan yet, but I could be mistaken on that. But anyway,
Bullet Club is interesting. That's basically in like three different companies now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the club is the Bullet Club. Like, they almost acknowledge it. It's just for trademark reasons, it can't be the Bullet Club.
Mm-hmm. But they also own the trademark, apparently, for the Balor Club.
That's true.
That was heavily reported.
That's a thing. I hope that's going to be a thing.
I hope that's going to be a thing, too, because I really think he as a heel is unreal, Finn Balor. But
yeah, when he was in New Japan and he started like riding on Bad Luck Fale to the ring and he had the light-up jacket, like, yeah, that was badass. That was just great.
Yeah, no, he is awesome. Awesome. As a bad guy. But anyway, we can get back to that in a second, but back to this match. And it's great because Colt Cabana, and he's talked about this. He kind of, you know, I don't think he's even alluded to it. I think he's straight up said that he was kind of driven out by sort of the Jim Cornette era, right? Of the regime of Jim Cornette.
And so he got to have a couple nice big triumphant comeback moments. And so this was a good match. This is one I should go out of my way to watch.
You should definitely go watch it. It's the two of them doing incredible things together. And like, you know, and we can talk about, I guess, Ring of Honor, and the problems with Ring of Honor, or I should say wrestlers' problems with Ring of Honor, leads into another thing we're going to be talking about soon with someone else that was, I guess, you know, according to rumor, at least, and maybe he's come out and said it, but kind of like driven away from Ring of Honor by the backstage handling of talent. But it's, you know, it's amazing that they still, you know, having been constantly plucked for people for years now, like years and years, like dating back to, you know, CM Punk and, you know, when Colt Cabana got plucked the first time and all that kind of stuff. It's still able to be that, I guess it's the number two, right? Would it be the number two?
In America? I don't know.
America.
I think TNA still does pretty good TV numbers, but I don't know.
I heard that if you look at, you know, because obviously, I guess, syndicated numbers aren't counted, but if you were to look at all the Sinclair stuff and the little cable number that it was doing too, Ring of Honor at one point was kind of beating TNA, and I might be mistaken on that.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really like to get into the business part of stuff too much because it's like it's you know, it's not my money,
and it also doesn't it that to me. Yeah, you're right, definitely. And also, I just think also those metrics are broken, like ratings and stuff like that. Like, I think a much better metric is just, you know, gauging from other wrestling fans, and it seems like to me people are
more psyched about ROH than TNA.
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah,
no, with the exception of the, you know, the deletion, because everyone loves the deletion.
That was something special. I really enjoyed deletion. That.
Oh.
That was like, I was going to not watch that for the longest time until I finally read enough things about it. And it was like, all right. And it absolutely surpassed every expectation I could have possibly had.
It's like I thought the thing that really threw me off is all the production values for everything else. And then the match starts and there's no crowd noise.
And it's so weird.
You get that live sound. Oh, it's so weird.
Yeah, one of my best friends from high school who was not a wrestling fan started texting me about it. That was when I was like, all right, I gotta watch this thing.
Yeah. it's amazing. Like, that could be a whole, like, everyone's, you know, that thing's been talked about to death. But just like the fact that that exists, you know, like that everyone.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing. Like that someone took, you know, the WCW crazy vignette to its illogical extreme.
Yep. But so we were talking about a guy who was in Ring of Honor and is no longer.
But before you do, I just want to say back to Colt Cabana, back to your point. I think he's still like a really under, and obviously maybe this is by his choice because he probably could sign a contract at this point, but what an underutilized talent that he's, you know, one of the most famous wrestlers outside of the WWE umbrella in the world at this point, you know, self-made and has a podcast that has, I don't know his numbers, but I would say hundreds of thousands of subscribers, I would imagine. And, you know, has that at his fingertips. It's just like the fact that he's not being used, you know, whatever it would take for him to be used by a company more directly is shocking to me.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think he has his own idea of how he wants to do things. He's got his whole like Ronin mentality and, that, you know, good for him. That's a cool thing. He seems to be doing just fine for himself as far as I can tell.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I still like, you know, I'm not saying that money walks and money talks, but you know, I'm surprised someone's not made him an offer that he couldn't refuse so he could come on board to help.
It would be smart.
Yeah.
But you know, we don't run a company. We don't know what we're talking about with this stuff.
Nope.
But so let's, can we talk about Cedric Alexander?
Yeah. So we were talking about the person we were alluding to before.
Yes. Cedric Alexander was in Ring of Honor and he is now part of the Cruiserweight Classic on, the WWE Network, which I talked about a whole bunch last week. Cruiserweight Classic had my favorite wrestling moment of the week last week and it had it again this past week with Cedric's match against Kota Ibushi, which was really something special, like something just very, very cool. This complete like nutso, like back and forth, super athletic, all over the place match. And it had its own sort of internally built-in storyline that the wrestlers had to tell. Like, they had to tell it themselves because the way the Cruiserweight Classic is set up, there's no storylines. It's just guys wrestling each other. So the storylines themselves have to sort of organically appear within the match. And this one did. This is like Cedric Alexander, been like a sort of a mid-card guy on the independent circuit for a long, 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 long time. And here he gets to kind of step up against the guy who's like maybe like the premier high flyer in the world. Like just this total like force of nature, Kota Ibushi, who's just an incredible, like breathtaking performer to watch. And he throws everything he has at him. And so that the whole story of the match is like, this guy knows he has one shot. He's doing everything he can. He doesn't win. You know, spoiler alert, like Ibushi wins, and you knew Ibushi was going to win going into it pretty much. But I mean, it was just nuts. And there were some near falls in there that were just beautiful. And it's just a great, great match, a whole lot of fun to watch. And he is a guy who was in Ring of Honor for a long time. And they actually alluded to it on the show. Like not this week, but whenever he had his first Cruiserweight Classic match, I think during the match, Mauro Ranallo said something about how he had passed up a Ring of Honor contract to be in the Cruiserweight Classic.
Well, and that it's just like, you know, that's the great thing about this Cruiserweight Classic is it's kind of giving a lot of these people exposure to a much wider audience. Like he was, you know, he definitely was a mid-card kind of wrestler on the independents, but he's someone that so many people have said for so long, and so many people have known for so long that he's just unbelievably physically gifted.
Yeah.
And
he is, he can just do incredible things. He's like, he can talk. He's like handsome. Like there's no reason why he couldn't succeed on a bigger stage.
No. And that's the thing is hopefully these guys are all going to like Kota Ibushi too. Like, you know, he's one of the greatest high flyers in the world, but just his facials in that match too. And
why do wrestling fans say facials instead of faces? Or facial expressions. I always thought that was one of the weirdest, like, wrestling terms.
Facials. I don't know. I think you say facials in other sports, don't you?
You say it in porn. It's something else there.
It means something very different, I think, in porn than we're talking about here. But, like, but maybe it's from wrestling that people say it. Like you know, in
MMA. I've never heard anybody say that in any context except for wrestling. It's one of those, why do we say this?
Yeah. Because
I've said it before. Anyway, I interrupted you.
No. Hey, your mind went there, Tom. So we had to go there. But yeah, you're right. But he's definitely one of those people that just, you know, one of my favorite wrestling matches, I think a lot of people's favorite wrestling matches the last few years, was Wrestle Kingdom 9 with Nakamura.
Yeah. Oh God. That was incredible.
I just watched it the other day because I'm showing Holden his first wrestling matches every morning before his younger brother wakes up. So we have like a 20 to 30 minute window before Dorian's downstairs and I have to turn off the wrestling.
Do you like think about it all day which one you're going to do the next morning?
Tom, I got them planned out like months in advance. I got them planned out till I can start showing them blood in a few years.
Okay, that's good.
Though I already fucked that up because I was trying to show him CM Punk versus Colt Cabana, and there's blood in the lead up. So I was like, okay. Oh God, I guess not ready to show you this one. but like the last one they had in Ring of Honor, I should say. So yeah, like he is really someone, and there's like so many people that you could say this of that are in this this tournament that just needed the platform. Cedric Alexander, yeah. Kota Ibushi, these are people that just needed the stage on which to show people what they can do.
So, all right. So then on the show, you know, they had this incredible match. Alexander loses and it cuts away at the end. And then, you know, it goes back to like the studio and guys talking about brackets and who's going to be wrestling the next week. But then almost as like a cold close of the show, it goes back and it shows Alexander like completely teary eyed, like leaving the ring. He's getting like a big, like, thank you, Cedric chant or something like that. And he's completely emotionally overcome. And I love moments like that in wrestling where it's like you actually see like the genuine emotion of it, where it's like wow, these guys have really like put themselves through something. This means everything to them. And these like I love it whenever like Sasha Banks cries after a big match. Mm-hmm. You know, I always love that stuff. And so the crowd starts chanting, "Please sign Cedric." And as he's walking to the back, you saw this too, right?
Yeah, WWE's put this excerpted out as another video on YouTube now.
Okay, so as he's like walking to the back, Triple H like suddenly materializes behind him, like steps out of the entranceway, and like looks up at the crowd and gives him like a yeah, okay, nod, like yeah, and like gives them a thumbs up, shakes Alexander's hand, and then like leads him to the back, and it's such a awesome moment. It's such a like a cool like nerd out thing. Like they didn't even have to put this on the show, but I'm really glad they did. And it really shows that like what a great wrestling fan Triple H is, that he could like recognize that as a moment. And first off, recognize that this is a guy who should be signed because he should. And then to like recognize that this would be a really cool moment to like go out and break the fourth wall enough to tell the crowd like, yeah, that's going to happen. Like we're going to put some money like in front of him and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. He's like, man, Triple H to me is like a very fascinating personality of a person. Cause like you get these moments with him and then, you know, he loves Motorhead and all this sort of other stuff where I'm like, how'd he be fun to hang out with? And then you hear, you know, stuff in the Jericho book or like other stories about how he is backstage, you know, like, oh, it just seems so completely at odds with this other side.
Yeah. Like the guy who holds other people down. And yeah. I've heard all the stories and stuff like that. I've been around a few wrestlers who've told me a few things and most of those things are not flattering. And, but I don't know, maybe it's like, he's gone through like personal changes in the last couple of years or sort of he's being an executive as opposed to a wrestler all the time, not really having a spot that he has to protect has like led him to sort of like consider things differently, almost like a president in the second term, you know, where they're not like for election the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just having his I'm at peace now with my ego years.
Yeah.
It's also like, this is, you know, that's one way. And the other way is like, maybe he is that calculating. Like he is, you know, he's the game. So maybe he's like figured out that like, no, this is what I need to be.
Oh, so like this is where the future is going. This is how to like bolster my own legacy. I like this. I like this line of thinking.
Evolution is a mystery, a change that no one sees, you know?
What? Are you quoting something? Is that the theme song?
Quoting the greatest theme song of all time in wrestling. I think I'm misquoting it too, but
okay.
But that's my favorite theme song. But yeah, like he can evolve, you know, he knows how to evolve. He's no,
you know, what's a great theme song is, this is apropos of nothing, but I really like James Storm's, TNA theme song. That's some like, that's some really top shelf, like Nashville, like mega budget mid 2000s, like country, like outlaw country, Montgomery Gentry type shit right there. That's good music.
What's Dixie's husband, Serge's work, I bet.
Probably, I'm sure. But like almost every theme song in TNA is just butt. Like most of them are terrible. James Storm got this like just badass anthem. Sounds like a, I don't even know, like a Lee Bryce song or something.
Well, because Serge was finally painting in his chosen palette at that point.
Yeah, I suppose that's it. As opposed to like the like Affliction shirt butt rock that everybody else gets.
Yeah, like Serge was like, I love Nashville country. Serge is the guy, though, that kept Taylor Wilde from using Fucked Up as her entrance music.
Yeah, you've told me this story.
So there you go. So Serge, not a fan of his work. Put it that way.
Yeah, fuck that guy. Except for his James Storm.
Except for the James Storm theme.
Although, have you heard Bobby Roode's new NXT theme song?
Yeah.
It's awesome. I like how both Beer Money guys have good theme songs in different companies now.
Well, because, and that's like, you know, it's funny when you think back. I went out for lunch with a friend the other day and we're talking some pro wrestling. And in we're talking about, you know, that sort of Motor City Machine Guns, Beer Money era of TNA. And just like, could you imagine if those teams were around now? And like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and like.
They would be crushing things. There's like no question.
It would be amazing. They both be on NXT. Like it's, I think it's very clear that both those teams, if they were around now and it was, if then was now, they would be on NXT and it would be blowing people's minds and there'd be this incredible push for tag teams.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that would be great. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
So the one thing that I also wanted to talk about this week, and God knows we probably should have bumped this up to the front because it's like the thing that people are actually talking about is the feud between The Rock and Vin Diesel,
mm-hmm.
which appears to be entirely taking place within TMZ and like The Rock's Instagram feed. But I'm really enjoying it. Like, I love the Fast and Furious movies. These guys apparently do not get along particularly well, and they are beefing with one another on the set of Fast 8, which I am very excited for. Do you like those movies?
No. I was dating a woman at the time when the first one came out, and I think she left me for a street racer.
Okay, but they're not even street racing movies anymore.
Doesn't matter, Tom.
Left you for like a vault cracking like iced superhero. I think you can go back to those movies and it's all good.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to like. There's so much stuff to watch. You know, like it's like when you have those spare times, do you really need to go back and discover the Fast series?
Yes. Yes, you do. They're like, it's the best action franchise we have going today. Well, it's like the last movie had Kurt Russell and Jason Statham and Tony Jaa and fucking, you know, The Rock like flexing and breaking a cast off his arm. It was just ridiculously dope. Those movies are great. They're fucking great. Fast 5, that's the best one. I went to this this action movie festival in Asheville, North Carolina, like 5 years ago, 4 years ago, something like that. And the guys who were there at the time were using Fast 5 because all these stuntmen were there, right? And they were using Fast 5 as like evidence of like our line of work is still relevant. They can't just replace us with computers because you need to do something like this fucking awesome bank vault dragging behind a car chase that is at the end of Fast 5. It's like one of the best car chases ever filmed.
Don't you think, though, it's like the Affliction t-shirt of movies?
No, because Affliction t-shirts aren't cool anymore and the Fast movies still are.
Are they, Tom?
Yes. That last, you know how much goddamn money Fast 7
made? Yeah, but we live in this weird area where populist equals good. That's like no other time in history.
Should I tell you that I cried at the end of it? Because I did.
Well, I cried at Backdraft. I'm not sitting here defending that movie.
Why would you not want to defend Backdraft, man?
I've never
seen Backdraft.
You've never seen Backdraft?
No, I've never seen Backdraft.
Okay, it's not good, but you should see it.
I mean, just like what you like. I like what I like. I write a fucking column about action.
I know I like, and I believe me, Tom. I like what I like. If we're sitting here talking about The Last Boy Scout, I can go.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
I can go. That's my favorite action movie ever. And
do you like it better than Die Hard?
Yep, I love Die Hard. I love Die Hard, and I just love Die Hard so much, and I love Die Hard 2 a lot. Three.
Die Hard 2 is like a distant behind Die Hard with a Vengeance.
I don't know. I think I like Die Hard 2 more than Die Hard with a Vengeance because I saw Die Hard 2 in the theater. So I've got a soft spot for
it. That would do it.
And there's that scene where he pulls the the ejection seat.
Yep.
And it goes right up into the screen. Oh, that's a classic thing to see.
That's like the waning days of the super shitty green screen effects.
Yeah.
You can only get away with that for like another 6 months after that.
So what's the beef between these two?
I don't know. I guess they like The Rock doesn't like the way Vin Diesel comports himself on set. The TMZ has reported that the crew all think that Vin Diesel sucks because he like he'll like hold up time or filming time because he won't come out of his trailer, and The Rock is a total professional. And so as a total professional, which you would have to become through years of pro wrestling, The Rock doesn't like that Vin Diesel is being a little bit of a diva. But so one of the theories that's been going around, and I think it's like a half joking theory, but God, I would love it if it was true, is that Fast 8 comes out like 2 months after or 2 weeks after WrestleMania next year. Yeah. And so there's some people who seem to think that this is a work, or don't seem to think, but they're at least enjoying speculating what if this was a work and what if it gets blown off at WrestleMania before the movie comes out.
Whoa. That would be some, that's like some, you know, Conor McGregor level of booking in advance.
It would be, I mean, all right, first off, in Fast Five, there is a fight between Vin Diesel and The Rock that is incredible. Even though Vin Diesel is like the size of like one of The Rock's legs, it makes it kind of the, you know, the camera work is such that it seems like he has a reasonable chance of holding his own. And God, like, so some things I'd like to think about, I'd just like to put out there into the ether is if this match does happen, if this is a wrestling match that this is building to, first off, what's Vin Diesel's entrance music?
Well, he was named by a hardcore kid, apparently.
He's not going to come out to some hardcore.
So he might come out to a hardcore song. No, he'd come out to one of those weird rave songs.
He's going to come out to that like Arthur Russell song that he like rapped on in 1986 or whatever it was. Or
that song, that rave song that he danced to. Remember those videos where he'd be like dancing, like high out of his mind, it looked like?
Yeah, he'll come out to what? Drunken Love, right?
Yeah.
That's his like most iconic like Facebook video that he put out.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So he comes out to Drunken Love. What kind of car does he drive to the ring? He has to drive a GTO. Like, and he has to drive it to the ring. I think that's the only way that happens. And then I wonder if he can do a shooting star press. I'm just going to put that out there. Maybe he could do a shooting star press. Like, he's cruiserweight sized.
Well, you think he can do a shooting star press? I bet you he's more like a power move guy. Bet you he's like...
Yes, probably. I want to put the image of Vin Diesel doing a shooting star press like out there in the world. Like it's like the secret, you know. Let's all sit there and picture it and think about it, and maybe it happens.
I think that's more realistic than Brock doing one on WrestleMania.
I mean, yeah. maybe Vin Diesel lands on his head like Brock does, and then they ban shooting star presses. I don't know. I can't predict the future.
Well, until that future comes, we should probably get our guest on right now.
Yeah, let's bring in Matador Records co-founder.
Yep.
Co-founder Gerard Cosley. Welcome back to Clobbering Time, everybody. And I'd like to introduce our esteemed guest, the Matador Records co-founder, guy who's been in music for a long time, Gerard Cosley. And hey. Kind of embarrassed I'm not saying that in a Blues Explosion voice.
I think it's better that you don't.
Yeah, probably.
Yo, Gerard, actually, totally off topic, but how about the fact that Russell Simmons, the other Russell Simmons from the John Spencer Blues Explosion, was in Psychic Youth?
Ah, you know what? I was not aware of that.
I didn't know about it till today when I was like entering the record into my Discogs page and I'm like, what the?
This is every conversation I have with you that's not about wrestling.
But that's like a boss. They were a Boston band too, right? I think.
It's not really ringing a bell for me. So
it's like some guy who went on to become the graphic designer who did the Slipknot record and he did a couple other things. But also featured Russell Simmons, and it's like kind of a minimal synth, electro-y pop type record. It's fantastic.
Wow.
But I had no idea. Anyway, sorry, I ruined the interview already, everyone.
We can get back on track.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, sorry, Tom. Back to you.
Damien is a Matador Records artist. And I applied for an internship once there in the summer of 2000 and never heard anything back. So that's both of our Matador Records connections.
I can promise you dodged a bullet.
Well, I would say, but you say that, Gerard, but let's not forget that Ezra from Vampire Weekend and Michael from Mishka were both former Matador interns.
That's what people tell me.
And also Gabe too. So there's
that's right. It's the ticket to stardom, much the way that CZW was Dean Ambrose's stepping stone to global fame and fortune. Packing boxes at Matador, you will eventually top the Billboard charts. That's how
that would have been my light tube match.
Yeah. You could have been. That could have been you, Tom. You could have been talking about Cousins instead of Ezra. That's a deep cut singles reference from like 3 years ago or something. All right.
So Gerard is a wrestling fan, just like the two of us. And Damien just told me you went and saw a Progress Wrestling show in London.
Yeah, I was in London in June and the end of June, and I attended Progress's Chapter 32 5001 card at the Electric Ballroom in Camden. 5001, of course, being the reference to Leicester City's recent EPL championship, which I'm told the odds for that were 5001. I'd never been to a Progress show before. I've only followed their stuff online.
Progress Wrestling, for those listeners who might not know, is a British wrestling promotion that like is incredible. Like it's kind of like the 2001 Ring of Honor of right now, where it's, it just seems like if you're a big enough wrestling dork, you're like, oh my God, this thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. And they seem to have a really, really good mix of sort of, you know, homegrown talent, bringing in a mix of the cooler, hotter indies from around the world. Mixing it up in a really creative way, because there seems to be an actual storyline for everything that's happening. Not that that's, unheard of in the indie world by any stretch. But even for somebody who hadn't been to one of the shows before, the characters and the storylines were pretty easy to figure out. The level of competition was fantastic. The production, the setup there was very, very cool. The crowd was amazing. Level of crowd participation was kind of off the charts, something I haven't seen at a domestic wrestling show in many, many years. I'm sold. I'm in.
You didn't go specifically for this, did you?
No, I was there on business and ended up extending the trip by an extra day when I saw that they had the show happening.
Nice.
There were a couple people on the show I'd seen before. Johnny Gargano, who dropped the Smash belt to Mark Haskins. Certainly have seen Johnny on TV here in the U.S. and seen him wrestle in person. But, there were a number of folks I had not watched before. One guy in particular, Jack Sexsmith, who seems to be working a gimmick of he's very promiscuous, which... You know, you wouldn't think on paper that's a great idea for a gimmick.
No, that's like Yujiro Takahashi kind of has that.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Yujiro gimmick.
Val Venus kind of sort of had it.
Yeah, it's a lot funnier than Val Venus. It's a little more.
Val Venus is pretty funny.
I'm with Gerard on this one. I think it could be probably a lot funnier than Val Venus.
Yeah, no, this guy is pretty damn funny. I mean, he's great on the microphone. He does some stuff that's pretty. I mean, I watched a clip of a match earlier in the year. I can't remember who it was with, but he comes into the ring with his tag partner, who is simply referred to as the Gimp. It's someone in a head to toe PVC suit who he is literally riding this person into the ring, and just before they get to the steps, Sexsmith falls off the Gimp and lands face first in the lap of someone in the front row. And it's just, it's amazing. That's awesome. It's really, really amazing. The guy's great on the mic. His interviews are very funny. And, I'd love to see him in a program with Dalton Castle.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be great. It's Wait, funny. Who did you go to the show by yourself?
Yes, I did. I did.
No one knows.
That's some true wrestling fandom to do that.
I go to most wrestling shows by myself.
Well, I was going
to
say, like, people, like, you know, people don't know this about Gerard. Like, you're kind of open about doing Can't Stop the Bleeding, right?
That is my blog. Yeah.
Yeah, because like the thing is, Gerard knows more about sports and music than just about anyone I've ever met in my entire life. Definitely more about, and when I say sports, I don't just mean like, you know, like sports, capital S. I mean pro wrestling too. And like, you've been to shows for a while, right? You've been going to shows. You're a lifelong fan, I would say, right?
Yeah, I've been going to wrestling shows since I was a kid. So yeah.
What were some of your first shows then?
The first show I saw was an independent show at Wayland High School when I was probably, probably 12 or 13. But I can't remember everybody on the card, but I believe Chief J. Strongbow was the headliner. So wow. that gives you a hint of how glittering that event must have been.
But also at that time, you kind of like, because of where you're situated, you're primed for the rise of the Northeast Indies in the wake of, I guess, WWE consolidating everything.
Yeah, although I didn't really follow it that closely. I probably started watching wrestling again in earnest maybe 83 or 84. I mean, I was at the first WrestleMania.
You were?
Yeah, I was there in the very last row of the blue seats at MSG. And my level of awareness about the independents at that time was virtually nothing. I mean, I knew about the NWA. I knew about the AWA. I knew about Florida Wrestling. I knew about Memphis. But all of that info I was just getting simply from reading the Bill After magazines. I hadn't started reading the Observer yet, so. It was all like a very shadowy world. I really, you know, was kind of stumbling through it, not knowing who was who and what was what. But I think the first time I got like a real notion that there was something else beyond the big players was right after the AWA had their like really abortive attempt at running shows in New York. They formed like a splinter group called Pro Wrestling USA. They did a big card at the Meadowlands. They did a big card at Nassau Coliseum, which wasn't very well attended. And from that point onwards, the shows started getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it was at that point that I began finding out that, oh, yeah, there's actually shows in things like VFW halls and American Legion halls and high school gymnasiums and nightclubs. And that was a pretty interesting revelation because you saw a number of people on their way up. And you saw a lot of people on their way down.
Yeah.
You were doing like Homestead and stuff by this point, right?
I started working at Homestead in 1984. I'm not the guy who started the label, but I started there in 1984 and I left at the start of 1990.
Okay, so when you're seeing all this stuff, these shows in VFW halls, did you see any like commonality between the music that you were dealing with and the wrestlers?
I would say virtually none. I mean, my vibe on it was, I had a very negative impression of what little I knew of the indie wrestling circuit at that point. I just assumed it was all very kind of, very, very kind of, I think the vibe I'm trying to describe is Carney-esque, mm-hmm. You know, and it wasn't until I started watching ECW that I had a higher opinion of it, that there actually seemed to be like a real aesthetic, that mm-hmm. somebody is saying here, this isn't simply garbage time wrestling to pull into town and draw 200 people. We have real stories. We have real characters. There's a real point of view being expressed here. It has something to do with, in some weird way, some bizarre prism that you know, Heyman and the other guys were looking through at that point in time, and yeah, it was ultra violent. You had some real larger than life personalities. It was hard not to admire the way they put those shows together. They were obviously heavily edited on TV. Mm-hmm. The whole business with Styles doing the commentary after the matches were over, that certainly allowed them to make for a better TV product. But yeah, I mean, that whole thing was really infectious. And then seeing those shows live for the first time, it did remind me a lot of seeing like Northeastern hardcore shows in the early 80s, especially the whole idea of the crowd being right on top of everything, the action happening in the crowd very often, and almost everybody involved being very, very accessible. You could go to the merch table and have a conversation with somebody about the match they were just in or whatever. And that was, you know, you obviously were not going to go to Madison Square Garden and just have a conversation with Jimmy Snuka. That wasn't going to happen. You weren't going to like just go up to Kevin Nash at intermission and be like, "Hey, how you doing?" You know.
Yeah.
So
was there ever like the sense, the sort of like hardcore show sense that like you could potentially get your ass kicked at one of these shows?
Absolutely. That I felt that way on many occasions, especially at the ECW shows at the Elks Lodge in Queens, where there was no real security to speak of.
Madhouse of Extreme.
Yeah, I mean. Some of the people in attendance were arguably a lot more unhinged than people in the ring. And, yeah, it's like, you know, it's like a really super hot, sweaty building, completely overpacked. People have been in there for hours and hours. Tempers were running high. Yeah, there was very often a feeling that something could seriously go wrong. And if you look at, I mean, and I never really saw anything super terrible happen, but I mean, there were like those legendary, you know, things that went wrong in and around ECW. There's the whole the Sandman crucifixion match. There's New Jack falling from God knows how many feet up in the air. There's the whole thing
missing with the tables.
You're missing the tables. The whole thing with mass transit nearly bleeding to death. I don't even know if that was even an actual ECW show. I can't remember.
It was. I went and spent some time with New Jack last year to write a profile about him for Grantland. Yeah. And I really kind of felt like I was going to go interview a lion. Like, I've never gone into an interview thinking that I could get stabbed before. I definitely kind of felt that. Heading into that.
Yeah, no, I totally get that, because watching those matches in that era, I felt like when things would spill into the crowd or when guys would be walking to the ring and some moron would get in their face, I often felt like, you know, there's a real chance that like Perry Saturn or Taz or one of those guys is going to haul off and slap somebody. But I always thought if that happens, that's circumstantial.
Yeah.
That's just kind of what happened in the heat of the moment. With New Jack, I definitely felt like there was a significant chance that someone who got too close to him could get hurt, and it wouldn't necessarily be unintended.
I have a video. I have a DVD where Shane Douglas, a fan, cracks him, and he turns around and slaps the fan, and just like slaps him down straight up, but. I don't know, New Jack, like, you had a good experience with him, right, Tom?
Yeah, he was fine. He was a tough interview.
Yeah.
He didn't want to answer too many questions as floridly as I might have liked
him. He didn't get stabbed, though, so it's pretty good.
No, did not get stabbed. And I never heard back from him about the story, so I guess he didn't hate it enough to, like, hunt me down.
That's good. So that's a positive.
Keep looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, no, I am.
Gerard, when you were going to, like, you know, WrestleMania 1, did you go by yourself? Because that was such, like, a huge media event. I imagine, were, like, other people around you excited about it at all? Or
I went to that with a coworker of mine named Mark, a guy I used to work with at Dutch East India Trading, who was also a wrestling fan. Yeah, I mean, people were very excited. And that was, I mean, at that time, the level of mainstream media attention that was being paid to that show was nothing like anyone had ever seen. Mm-hmm. If you'll remember, the night before WrestleMania, Hogan and Mr. T hosted SNL. That's how big this was. That was also the week that Hogan put Richard Belzer in the sleeper hold and dropped him on his head. That was in doing advanced promo for WrestleMania. So yeah, it was a very, very big deal. It was sort of treated by the media in kind of a sneering sort of way. I mean, it was compared to now when you have Coachman on SportsCenter having like pseudo legit conversations with guys about their injuries or their title aspirations. Most of the news and sports media covering the old WWF at that time were pretty, you know, I mean, it was pretty nudge nudge. We think this is silly, but we know you're going to pay attention to it.
Mm. Well, like ESPN just launched a WWE vertical yesterday, I think, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's smart business. Whether it's good journalism, I can't say, but it's certainly good business. I have a lot of I tend to think that those Coachman things they're doing don't do them or the WWE any favors. But that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could hear that. I think it's funny though, because around that era, I've read a lot of interesting wrestling articles written by the singer of Vom, Richard Metzger? Meltzer?
Meltzer, yes.
Meltzer, Richard Meltzer, yes. Sorry.
But, Richard, a.k.a. the real dean of American Rock Critics.
Exactly.
Oh, shots fired at Chris Gow.
Yeah, well, that his books are incredible. The Aesthetics of Rock, and there's another
Is
one.
Is he really Dave Meltzer's cousin? Somebody told me that once.
They're not actually related, but it's an amazing
coincidence. I really like that idea.
Yeah, it would be incredible because, well, that's someone who's like, you know, wrote lyrics for Blue Oyster Cult and played in, you know, the pre-Angry Simone's band and also loved pro wrestling. And
I just want to say I'm gonna defend Robert Christgau really quick. As a rock critic, I think he's a much better writer than Meltzer. And also, like, I worked with him for a little while and he was nice to me.
I actually hold him in very high regard. I'm clearly have my own biases here, but I'm not seriously trying to diss Chris Gow.
Well, but he never wrote Electrocute Mike Cock, so
not yet.
There you go.
He wrote a lot about his dick, like more than it would be advised for a rock critic today to write about his dick.
That's well, yeah. No, I don't think that would fly in today's world. But you mentioned the other. Meltzer, Dave Meltzer. When did you start subscribing to The Observer?
I haven't been a constant subscriber during all this time, but I probably started around, I'm going to guess around 86 or 87.
Wow. So how did you become like aware that there was this other world that you weren't privy to?
You know what? It was actually, I'm not trying to name drop here. It was Bob Mould who told me about The Observer. I'd never heard of it before. And I didn't even, I mean, as far as like, you know, wrestling zines existing. And I know, for instance, that, you know, when Cornette was a young person, he was involved in some DIY publishing stuff, which I've never actually seen any of it. But it was Bob who told me about The Observer. And that was before there was a website or before most of us were online. And, you would get the print edition in the mail. And, it was an absolute mind blower because, yeah, here's this guy discussing it in a very serious, very analytical way. And he's not pretending that the results aren't prearranged. Mm-hmm. And he's also discussing the business in very, very stark terms. You're learning a ton about how that business works, who's doing what, who's getting paid. It was both very, very addictive, but also very sobering at the same time because there were so many really, really tragic stories about people getting messed up, people suffering, things really going wrong in people's lives and careers, and the publication's still like that today, except it's much, much bigger. And of course, Dave has gone on to be one of the foremost writers in the MMA world as well, which, you know, back then didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Had you seen Bob's wrestling zine? Because he had one prior to that, right? Prior to 86, I mean.
I hadn't seen Bob's wrestling zine. I know there is one zine that recently somebody put up a PDF of that has contributions from Bob and one of the guys from Toxic Reasons. But like if Bob had his own zine, I never actually saw it.
Yeah, that's what I think. He told me that he had his own one for a minute too. I'm pretty sure. But like that one also, I think it has the guy from the Stretch Marks contributing.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same publication.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny. There's always been this weird connection between punk and pro wrestling, or a lot of punks that like pro wrestling.
Yeah, and it pops up in the songs a lot. I mean, yep. For years. I mean, going back to the 80s, there have been songs where there have been, you know, very, very specific references. So it's not a new thing at all.
Mm-hmm. What's that band, The Foreign Objects? They were from Northwest, right? Or Northeast, I should say.
Yeah, I think they were a Boston thing. I think they, a band called the Mighty Ions from Boston. Who they had a song called Pedro Morales, which was sung to the tune of California Uber Allies. that was a big hit. By big hit, I mean it was a big hit on college radio on one station, where one of them may have been a DJ. But yeah, I mean it was, I guess it was a little closeted in those days. I mean,
I think he probably still is, like. Yeah. Maybe not as much.
I mean, if I go to a punk rock show these days, or you know, quote unquote indie rock show or whatever, it's not at all unusual to see somebody with a wrestling tee.
Yeah.
But they're still in the minority, of course.
we're in the post CM Punk profile in GQ magazine era, Tom. You got to remember that sometimes.
Yeah. It was only the website. I can't claim too much. Responsibility for
when,
anything.
When it's brought up in wrestling media, it's always brought up like it was in the magazine.
Yeah, no, I know. Do you have a favorite wrestling show you've ever been to?
I gotta think about that. Probably the first ECW pay-per-view at what they now call the 2300 Arena. In Philadelphia, I'm trying to remember
it's the one in Beyond the Mat, right? That's the one.
Yeah, that was. I think that was Raven versus Terry Funk was the headline match that night, and
they had like a three-way dance to see like that Terry Funk had to win to get in that match. Was that the one?
I think so. There was a tremendous amount of blood. Spilled on Terry's part. I believe there was another match on that card that featured a surprise Rick Rude appearance. But yeah, I mean, that was a pretty amazing night because, again, the crowd had a lot to do with making that show.
Is it Barely Legal? It was the Barely Legal one? Was that?
I think Barely Legal was... I think the first one was Barely Legal, and maybe Heat Wave was the second one.
Cause and the power goes out at the end or something, right? Or
yeah,
that must have been incredible. What was your first ECW show? Because were you aware of it from reading the Observer as it was kind of happening, or
my finding out about ECW was completely by accident. They were probably a good 4 or 5 years in by the time I knew about it, and there was a cable channel in New York, still a big cable channel, MSG,
mm-hmm.
Madison Square Garden TV. And they were buying TV time on MSG very late.
Like 4 in the morning or something, right?
Yeah, like I think like 2 in the morning. Like
yeah,
in the morning
I think that's like five. That's how I saw it for the first time, too. Yeah. Except by then it was like 98 or something.
Yeah, and I was probably like maybe like sometime in 96 or 97. I probably just left the TV on from watching a Knicks game or something. And you know, I come home and there's this wrestling show on the TV. And, you know, there's chairs flying everywhere. There's guys getting stapled in the head. you've got Styles screaming his brains out. You got Bill Alfonso, like, acting like a complete, like, you know, cracked out maniac with that horrible horrible orange jumpsuit. I mean, yeah, there, it was. I mean, immediately I was like, "Oh my god, this is crazy! This is hilarious TV." And the way that like certain people kept kind of popping into it, who I remembered from wrestling before, like seeing Terry Funk on those shows, or seeing Buddy Roberts on those shows, or seeing Tracy Smothers. It was like, "Oh my god, where did these guys fit into it?" It was pretty cool.
Like, was it with the ECW stuff? Were there other like people you saw? I guess by that point, like were there like other like was it a punk audience at all, or was it like
no, definitely not. I mean, I would go to those shows and pretty much know absolutely no one. There was one guy, coincidentally at the time, a dude who was a publicist for Geffen Records, who was also going to those shows, and he and I were not. Acquaintances at that point.
Yeah.
But I believe he was the one responsible, I could be wrong about this, but I believe he was the one responsible for Mikey Whipwreck using Beck's A Loser as his entry music. And by responsible, I mean he was the one who was going to get blamed if Geffen's lawyers ever found out about it.
I always thought they just did all those, like, they just used whatever music they felt like and didn't even worry about getting sued.
Well, that's mostly true. I mean, they didn't ask permission. They didn't pay a licensing fee or whatever. I mean, that's why it worked. Because they were using real music, people got super psyched for it. Mm-hmm. But, of course, in real life, they couldn't use the real music. I ended up having a very brief dialogue with Paul Heyman, and because
they used that the Blues Explosion Jizza remix, right, for like a video package.
No, well, no, they used the Blues Explosion's Whale for Rob Van Dam's ring entry music.
Oh, that's...
However, after I think maybe two or three times. They decided that it wasn't working, that people weren't recognizing the song, that it didn't really resonate with the audience, and they changed it to something else.
Pantera.
Which is pretty embarrassing. But,
well, it's got to be the Pantera. Like, it's cool that he used Blues Explosion for a minute, but that Pantera entrance, that's like one of the all-time great wrestler song pairings.
When a guy comes out in an airbrush singlet with a yin-yang motif, you know there's got to be some Pantera closely behind.
Yeah, I think you're right. We made a deal with Paul, and this is, again, you know, something that our own lawyers probably wouldn't have been keen on, but we made a deal with him where they would use the Blues Explosion song as Rob Van Dam's music, and we got a Blues Explosion commercial on the ECW show, which I think maybe they showed it twice, and I don't think I ever encountered a single person who told me they saw the commercial on the show. I mean, I know it was on because I watched it myself. I'm not saying Paul ripped us off, but in terms of like whatever impact it had,
yeah, the effectiveness has yet to been seen. Yeah.
I think Paul just thought, oh, cool, like Matador Records, alternative rock, it must be a huge thing. I'm sure the two will go great together. When in fact, I don't think the two audiences wanted to have anything whatsoever to do with each other.
Well, did he come off as a music guy at all? Like
not really a music guy, but he came off as a hustler, and I mean that in the best possible sense mm-hmm. of the word. I don't mean that as a derogatory thing. He came off as a guy who was super enthusiastic about what he was doing, believed in it 110%, and was like completely driven to get it done. And anytime I had a conversation with him, it was just like super brief because he had something else to do, something more important to get to, and I was completely cool with that. Yeah, I mean those shows were absolutely amazing, and trying to watch them today on the network with all the music and crowd noise taken up, it's excruciating.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like I could show it to somebody today and they would have no idea what the big deal was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how, like, and it goes back to what you're talking about with progress and stuff. Like, it's how when you pick an aesthetic for your company and you're just able to kind of run with that aesthetic, how far that takes you in independent wrestling, because it just makes you stand out rather than just being the company that features wrestling that's not quite like the stuff you see on TV. You're the company that doesn't want to be like the stuff you see on TV.
Yeah, I agree.
I meant to. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
Well, I meant to ask, like, bringing it back, like, at that Progress show, was the, obviously they're, you know, completely different like forms of wrestling, but it, was the excitement in the room anything similar to what it was at those ECW shows?
A little different. It was definitely not as bloodthirsty. I mean, I think at the ECW shows, and I got to be careful how I put this because I'm probably incriminating myself here, but I think you definitely had a certain element at those ECW shows that really just wanted to see people get fucked up and get fucked up badly. Whereas the crowd at the Progress show, and keep in mind, I'm making generalizations about people I don't even know, but the crowd seemed very educated, definitely knew the promotion, knew the wrestlers, knew the sport. And I would say the atmosphere was probably closer to that of an English football match, except not as bro heavy, not as generic. I mean, again, this is an audience that definitely had a real sense of humor, and the workers were feeding off of them, and vice versa. I don't just mean in terms of energy. I mean, in terms of like kind of like a running dialogue, and it was cool.
Well, it's funny because like they have a lot of punk references, and obviously a bunch of their wrestlers are punk people. But I was Tommy End was doing like a Q&A on Twitter this week, and I hit him up, and I'm like NRA or Funeral Oration because, you know, being Dutch and punk, yeah. And he was like Jesus and the Gospel Fuckers, and I was like touche.
Speaking another language right now. I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's like going to someone, Hulk Hogan or Macho Man, okay. And they go Nakamura.
It's like, all right.
It's
okay.
It's like a deeper cut type thing. But it'd be kind of back then. I don't know. I can't think of. My mind's not working right. I don't know. What would you say? It's like Gerard.
We've had this going for a little while. We should probably cut it off because we don't want the podcast to go too long this week. But Gerard, thank you so much for being on our wrestling show.
Anytime, guys.
Awesome, Gerard. Yeah, thank you so much. And why don't we just wrap the wrestling show right now?
All right, cool. Yeah. Should we plug our shit?
Yeah, I guess, Gerard, why don't you plug Can't Stop the Bleeding, and I guess on Twitter, if you want people to hit you up, Can't Stop the Bleeding up on Twitter, too, and stuff?
Yeah, people can follow me, if they're inclined, at CSTBTweet. The blog is can'tstopthebleeding.com.
It's amazing. It is hilarious. And Gerard posts a lot of wrestling content too. And yeah, I just had to put your plug in a little harder than you were going to plug it, Gerard.
Thanks. I'm not big on plugging myself. So no. Thank you, sir.
No. And you put out some records too, I hear. So check that out.
Apparently. But we have a big marketing campaign. So just look for the Matador Records, billboards and Skyriders, in your city.
Exactly. I guess, sorry, Tom.
I'm on Twitter at Tom Bryan. My stuff is on stereogum.com just about every day, although I've been on vacation this week. And my AV Club action movie column just ran its first blood piece. So look for that if you were so inclined. And go ahead, Damien.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff at Leffert Damien. And subscribe to this Turned Out of Punk feed, because that's where you're going to be hearing Clobbering Time for the next little bit until we get our own feed and get our logo, which is coming along really cool, Tom. I've seen some mock-ups for it. My dad's doing it. That's it. And then, I write stuff on Vice and I will see you on another podcast on this channel.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.